How can I make myself more competitive?
How do I build my network?
I want my career to go to the next level, but I don't really know where to start.
I hate the job I am in. What else can I do?
I want to work in healthcare, but I don't want to be a doctor.
I need connections in a new industry. Where should I start?
Whether you're a college student trying to decide on a career path, a young professional trying to develop their career, or maybe you're in the mid to late stages of your own professional journey and you're looking for a new challenge, or maybe you're facing an unexpected job search. Whoever you are, wherever you are, welcome to the Professionists Podcast. And together, let's find your fit. Welcome to another episode of the Professionists Podcast, where we explore career paths, professional development and soft skills, and where we explore the career journeys of seasoned professionals. In today's episode, we're exploring the career path of a physician assistant, not a physician's assistant, which is something we discovered during our research for this interview. PAs, as they're commonly known, work in a number of healthcare settings, including hospitals, outpatient clinics, the military, and even in surgical settings. They spend the majority of their time interacting with patients, and as licensed healthcare professionals, they conduct examinations, diagnose and treat illnesses, and assist in things like surgery. While the role is similar in some ways to that of a nurse practitioner, they do require very different educational paths. Like many healthcare professionals, PAs will spend the majority of their workday on their feet meeting with patients and doing rounds, although they do have administrative and desk duties that form part of their ordinary responsibilities. In order to qualify as a physician assistant, you will require a very specific undergraduate degree that covers a number of necessary prerequisites. Many PA schools also require their applicants to have a mandatory minimum GPA. This will vary from one school to another, but it's common to see requirements of somewhere between a 3.0 and a 3.2. And in most cases where that GPA is stipulated, it is a condition of being admitted. We'll talk about that in this episode. It is also extremely common for programs to require specific experience before gaining admission, with significant numbers of patient contact hours. In many ways, becoming a PA is one of the most competitive programs because there is such a small number of schools that offer PA degrees when compared with things like dentistry and medicine. Now, after taking the GRE and submitting an application to a PA school, successful applicants will need to complete their PA studies, which usually require 2 years on a full-time basis. That includes both classroom work, but also clinical training. And PAs are able to specialize in a number of areas. These include, but aren't limited to, emergency medicine, dermatology, urology, surgery, pediatrics, neurology, and even family medicine. Now, it's important to select a degree program that is accredited by the Accreditation Review Commission for Physician Assistants, which is referred to as the ARC-PA, the ARC-PA. Now, after completing your PA studies, those who want to go on and practice as a PA will need to pass the PANCE exam, P-A-N-C-E. It stands for the Physician Assistant National Certifying Examination. There will also be various state-specific requirements that you need to be alert to, and you should look at those depending on where you are in the United States. Now, upon completion of your studies and the requisite licensure, successful applicants can then go on and practice using the designation PA-C. Now, a related designation that you may see as you investigate this profession is PA-S. That stands for PA student. Like many other professions, PAs are required to stay up to date on developments within their area, and as such, they need to continue their education on a rolling basis. They must also take a recertification exam, generally speaking every 10 years, and they're required to pay various professional fees in order to maintain their accreditation. In terms of both pay and job satisfaction, PAs are able to boast an average salary of $118,000, which is almost double that of an average first-year attorney, with a third of them receiving some kind of incentive or productivity bonus based on the studies that we found. What is also important to note is that between 2019 and 2029, the US Bureau of Labor Statistics has predicted a growth in the PA profession of 31%, which is huge. especially when it's compared with the rate of 4% that was predicted for all occupations as a single group, and 10% for those within diagnosing and treating professions. And again, all of this information is from the US Bureau of Labor Statistics. A recent survey found that 74% of PAs interviewed considered their pay fair, and 92% of them were glad that they had become PAs. Today's guest is going to help us explore the path to a career as a physician assistant and the day-to-day realities of the role. She's a graduate of the University of Georgia and Georgia Regents University and currently works as a PA specializing in dermatology. Alongside her dermatology practice, she has also founded the PA Platform, a website dedicated to helping aspiring PAs reach their goals. The PA Platform provides all kinds of services, including application assistance, interview prep, and also hosts the PA Platform. Today's guest is Savannah Perry. Welcome, Savannah.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
We're glad that you could join us. If you're in front of your computer or on your phone as you're listening to this and you want to find out more about Savannah and the services that she provides, head on over to www.thepaplatform.com. It is your one-stop shop for all things pre-PA. You can get all kinds of great hacks and help as you prepare your own application and as you consider this profession. And you can get help from the PA Platform, whether it's looking at a personal statement, preparing for mock interviews, coming up with a strategy. Head on over to thepaplatform.com. Now, if you head on over there, you can use the discount code FUTUREPA. That is FUTUREPA. Is it case sensitive, Savannah?
Nope, not at all.
Okay, so the FUTUREPA, and you'll get a 10% discount on all of the services that are available over on the website. You can also follow Savannah at the PA Platform on Instagram. She's also the host of the Pre-PA podcast, which is on all good podcasting services. Savannah, you've got an interesting story, but before we jump into that, I'd really like to figure out, what was it about entering into a helping profession that was so appealing to you?
Gosh, that is a common question that I've been answering since I decided to become a PA. It comes up a lot. And by the way, you're hired if we ever do a commercial. You have a great podcasting voice. And anyway, so as far as how I kind of got into thinking that I wanted to be in a position where I was helping people medically and in a healthcare setting, I think I'm one of those people that has somewhat of a natural inclination towards medicine and sciences. It's just what I'm interested in. And how that turned into wanting to help other people in that really was kind of a personal experience growing up. My sister has an autoimmune disorder. She's 3 years younger than me. And she started having really high fevers as a baby. So she was in and out of doctor's offices pretty much our whole childhood. And being the bigger sister, I got dragged along to appointments. And some kids are deathly afraid of doctors and injections and things. I always thought it was really interesting. But what I found interesting about her situation was seeing doctors who were just as happy to hold her down and draw her blood and didn't really seem to care. And then other doctors who were awesome and would call my mom at 6 o'clock on a Friday night because a new paper came out that they thought might help my sister. And so seeing that kind of made me go, I want to be like that doctor. Like, that's really cool. He's really helping us. And continuing to be interested in science, that turned into, as a high schooler, starting to think about my career, really looking at what I could do in medicine to combine my desire to focus on kind of that science part of things that I loved and getting to really interact with people, which I enjoy also.
Did you know what a physician assistant was at that point, or is it something you stumbled on later on?
I didn't know what a PA was until I'm not sure if I was a junior or senior in high school, but somewhere in that area, when I was kind of starting to think about college, starting to really think about what I wanted to do, people are asking you know, I was thinking maybe I'll go to medical school and be a doctor, maybe I'll be a nurse. And my dad is the one who told me about PAs. I had never heard of it. He went to see the doctor for just a cold, kind of an urgent care thing, and he ended up seeing a PA. He came home just super excited, and this is circa 2006, 2007, and he had printed out an entire folder of probably 50 pages of paper with all the research he could find about PAs. And so, I mean, it was nice, super sweet of him, but I didn't really think about it too much. It did plant that seed in me, though, that once I got to UGA, the University of Georgia, I was a biology major. I started really thinking about things, and PA kept coming up as an option for me. And just because he had said, you know, this girl was awesome. She was able to take care of me. She wrote my prescription. She reminded me of you. This would be a great job for you, which we're all like, no, we don't care what our parents say. But for me, it really was. I mean, he was right. He knew me.
What did you do in college to kind of flesh that out a little bit beyond what you'd heard from your dad? Did you talk to anyone? Because it's a fairly new profession in the scheme of things.
Yes, it is. I did a lot of soul searching and researching. I am an over researcher by nature. If I plan a trip, I'm going to read every hotel review for hours before I pick one, if that tells you anything. And so I spent a lot of time. I basically had a notebook where I said, okay, I'm a biology major. What can I do with that? And I researched and went through every profession I could think of: med school, dental school, PA, PT, which is physical therapy, nursing, nurse practitioner, nurse anesthetist, occupational therapy, respiratory therapy, research, teaching, anything I could come up with as an option. I looked into job satisfaction, what I needed to achieve that profession, salary, what the job actually looked like, what were you doing on a daily basis. And through all of that research, while struggling through difficult freshman year chemistry classes at UGA, I really narrowed it down to, I want to be involved with my patients on a level where I'm involved in their decision making and making an impact in that way, and having conversations where I can educate them about their care and what's going on. And I really want to understand those things. So that took a lot of things off the table and left me pretty much with medical school or PA school. I kind of thought about nursing, but I don't particularly have like a nursing personality. I think that's changed a little bit since I've had a child, but I tend to be very direct. And my college roommate actually went to nursing school. And I'm like, you are the perfect person for that. And for me at that point also, I had already started my bachelor's degree and I had a year under my belt. Mm-hmm. And so it would have been backtracking also for me to switch to a nursing track at that point. If I had started on that route, it would have made more sense.
So there wasn't that many common courses that you would have had to.
The classes, right. At my university, the classes for nursing versus a regular biology degree were very different. And so I'd already completed what I felt were too many difficult weed out classes to switch over. And so then going home over the summer, I started shadowing, and that's what really helped me decide. I was very fortunate to have an opportunity to shadow both a PA and a doctor. They were a team. So they worked together. They both worked in hospitalist and wound care medicine. So they would go to four different hospitals in the area. And I would go with the PA sometimes, I would go with the doctor sometimes, and sometimes we'd all be together. And I did this for a couple weeks. So I got a good feel of their routine and their relationship and what they did. And in seeing those things firsthand, it helped me make some big decisions, and I saw myself as the PA. She was young, she was confident, she was knowledgeable, she was organized, a lot of qualities that I felt I also had. Mm-hmm. And while she was doing very similar things to the physician, they were also working together. And I saw firsthand how that impacted patient care and led to better care. Because instead of one person calling all the shots, now you have two people putting their heads together and their experience and their knowledge. And I just thought it was great. And I loved watching her interact with patients. It also, in kind of seeing that and thinking, okay, I think this is the way I want to go, I started to get excited about my education and my future rather than feeling kind of the weight on my shoulders I had felt during freshman year of, oh my gosh, if I don't, you know, get all this done, I'll never get into med school, or I'm competing with all these people and these are people I'm going to compete with in medical school, and just not feeling like I would do well enough to get the residency I wanted. And then what am I going to do? And it just felt very daunting to take on all of the steps involved with becoming a doctor. And I didn't want to be in school forever. I've always been somebody out there, like, ready to get out and work. And so to hear, you know, I could be 24 starting my career, I said, I'm ready for that. Let's do it. And I'm happy I did. Spoiler alert.
One of the things I think is really a key point for people to listen to is that you mentioned that you shadowed. And, you know, one of the things we encourage, and there is an episode of this season where we actually talk about informational interviews and the importance of talking to people who are doing the kinds of things that you're interested in. How did you go about securing those opportunities? Because I think that is, it makes sense to shadow, but I think a lot of people are intimidated by how you actually go about that, especially if you don't have any medical connections in your family.
Yeah, it's difficult. And I'd say this past year, it's been even more difficult.
Yeah.
But I and no one in my immediate family is medical. My parents are teachers. And so with shadowing, I took a few different approaches. I think the first way to find opportunities is to use the circles that are closest to you. So start with family and friends, but tell everyone you want to be a PA, because you just don't know who people know. And even if it's your neighbor's cousin's best friend, they may have a connection for you to get you in the door. So my connection was one of my dad's friends from his job. He taught welding at a community college, or a technical college. One of his friends, or somebody he had connected with through work, was an administrator at a rehab hospital and knew this PA and had kind of been involved with hiring her. And so he was able to ask her and be the person to say, it's okay for me to shadow, to let me be able to do that. The other opportunities I found, I shadowed an orthopedic PA that was one of my high school friend's dad's PAs. Their dad was an orthopedic surgeon and he had a PA, so I was able to connect there. I also shadowed orthopedic back surgery PA, and I connected with her because her fiance went to my church and was basically friends with some of my friends. He was kind of a mentor to a lot of the like college guys. And so there was like a very distant connection where they're like, oh, your girlfriend's a PA. We know this girl who wants to be a PA. And then once I started shadowing, some of those PAs knew other PAs that they could connect me with.
And you had social credibility because they'd interacted with you.
Exactly.
They liked you and they're like, you know what? I can vouch for this girl.
Yes. And that's the thing. Having somebody to vouch for you versus a random person that you don't know, it makes a huge difference. The other way I went about it was cold calling offices. In Athens, where I went to school, I didn't know anybody. I had no connections at all. That was back when they still did real phone books. I don't know if those still exist, but so this was probably like 2010, and a phone book ended up on our front porch, and I had been trying to find shadowing. And so I sat there for a day and I went through the entire phone book, all of the medical offices, and I called every single one because not everyone lists online that they have PAs. So I would call and I would say, hi, do you have any PAs? And if they said yes, I would say, can I speak with your office manager? Because that's who makes decisions. And so they would either usually connect me to a voicemail or give me an email address. I think I only talked to a few actual managers at the time, but they would connect me and I would leave a message saying, "Hi, my name's Savannah. I'm a student at UGA. I'm interested in the PA profession and I was calling to inquire about any shadowing opportunities. Please call me back." And out of all of those places and hours of calling, two places called me back. One was an orthopedic office. They asked for a resume. I sent it and never heard back. And the other one was a dermatology PA. And she was amazing. And it made all of that hard work worth it because she let me come shadow her once a week for a whole afternoon for about a year. So oh, wow. I was going, getting tons of hours, tons of experience, figuring out I like dermatology, and also making this relationship with this PA who was awesome. And, you know, I think, like, speaking to what you said as far as students being scared to reach out, I get it. You don't want to inconvenience anyone. And it is intimidating to ask people who are in the positions you want to be in for help. But at the end of the day, the worst thing that's going to happen is they say no, or they just don't respond. They're not going to be mean to you. And most of the time, PAs love their jobs and they want to talk about it. Even if they can't have you shadow, if you ask for a conversation and start building those relationships and connections, that gives you that credibility that you are also speaking to, that one day you may be able to shadow or they can help you find more opportunities.
I mean, it's human nature. It's very flattering for someone to call you and say, "I want to be like you. Can you spare me 20 to 30 minutes? Right. I think the other thing that you mentioned is probably worth just adding a little comment to is when you say you make all these phone calls and you get sent through to voicemail, a lot of people, at least initially, that feels like failure. The voicemail is where you want to be because people check their own voicemail. It doesn't get filtered through a secretary or a front desk receptionist. If you go to the voicemail of office manager X, that office manager will check their own voicemail and you've had a chance to speak directly to them. And so in many cases, whether it's doctors, lawyers, PAs, engineers, the voicemail is a great place for you to land.
Totally agree. And don't discount the other thing I would say about shadowing, especially right now, is don't discount your state societies or your even the national one, which is the AAPA, but state ones specifically. Some of them have shadowing opportunities or contacts, or just get involved. State, you know, I'm part of the Georgia Association of PAs. It's made up of all PAs. So if you contact them and ask how you can help, you're going to make some great connections of exactly who you're trying to get in touch with.
Yeah, that's a great tip. Tell us about the application process itself. Let's say we've started to get interested in this profession. What does the application process itself look like?
There are a lot of steps that happen before you are ready to apply to PA school. And that's one thing that makes it difficult if someone does decide later on to become a PA. I would say very rarely is someone just qualified right away to go ahead and apply. It's going to take some work. And part of the reasoning behind that is PA school applications are not standardized. So every school has different requirements. They have different prerequisite requirements, different timelines for when those prereqs need to be completed, different patient care, volunteering, shadowing, testing, everything is different, deadlines. And so that makes it tedious for applicants because if you really want to make your best impression as an applicant, you need to make sure that you've covered your bases to make sure you're qualified before you apply. So the first thing is getting the prerequisite courses and having a degree, having a bachelor's degree. At that point, once you've completed the classes, most programs have a minimum grade requirement and a minimum GPA. Most schools also require patient care experience, which is directly working with patients in some capacity. That can be a CNA, a medical assistant, patient care tech, an EMT, a paramedic, a nurse, lots of different opportunities there.
Could you just before you move on, could you just explain the difference between that and healthcare experience?
Yes. So then there's healthcare experience, which patient care experience is more preferred. You don't necessarily have to have both, but patient care is better. Healthcare experience is working in a medical setting, but not directly with patients. That's more like being a receptionist or a transporter. Scribing is kind of a gray area that falls in between the two, and it's very program dependent. Okay. There's also teaching experience, research, leadership, extracurriculars, volunteer experience, and shadowing. So volunteering, schools are looking for dedicated volunteer experience over a period of time, really giving back to the community and showing you're passionate about something. If you're saying, you know, I want to help people, you really need to have demonstrated that already. And then shadowing, like we talked about, they're wanting to see that you understand the profession, that you know what a PA is, because on paper it looks like a great job, but until you've seen it to make sure you really want to do it, you may not know. Letters of recommendation, need 3 to 5 of those, usually from a professor.
That seems like a lot, 3 to 5.
Three to five, a professor, a PA, sometimes a doctor, sometimes a supervisor, and then testing. So there are different tests required for a PA school, and not all schools require tests, but the GRE is the most widely required. There is a newer test called the PA-CAT, which is more similar to the MCAT, or what do y'all take from law school?
So the law school, it's the LSAT, although there are some schools that have started to take the GRE and some schools that have really strong business schools that will take the GMAT.
Okay, interesting.
As an alternative. But yeah, the predominant test is the LSAT, and it's not content-based. And so I guess one of the follow-up questions I have, it's more logic than content.
Okay.
And so I guess the follow-up question is, what if I had planned on going to medical school and, you know, I had the prereqs and I'd taken the MCAT and I hadn't been able to get into medical school, can I use that MCAT for PA school, or do I have to go back and take the GRE?
So not for most schools.
Okay.
There's only a very small handful. I think we're up to almost 300 programs now. And I think the last thing I saw was maybe 20 or 30 of them would accept the MCAT. So it's a very small handful that will accept it. And most don't. There are none that I know of that actually require it. There are just some that will accept it in place of the GRE.
And I've seen, too, that some schools, I mean, they're very narrow circumstances, but there are some cases where it seems if you've got a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, that they may waive that GRE component. Have you heard of that, or am I?
Not frequently for PA school, but most of the time, I would say for what happens in PA school is if you've gotten a master's, if it's recent, your GRE scores would still count from when you applied for that, because they count for 5 years. I've seen there aren't many requirements that are waived. Every once in a while, I'll see them waive. Like if you were an anatomy teacher for 10 years, they might waive the, like say that, oh, you're, even though your class was 15 years ago, you don't have to retake it, kind of thing. But those exceptions are few and far between and very situational.
Well, this is probably a good place to jump into the weeds a little bit.
Okay.
You know, I know that some of these schools have cutoffs on GPA. So some schools it's 3.2, some, and I think it's the UT system, I think it's a 3.0. I don't quote me on that. Please go and check that for your own records. But what do you do if your GPA falls below that? Let's say maybe you started out in a major that really wasn't something you were passionate about, or maybe you had a bunch of stuff going on that affected your grades, or maybe you're just immature and you graduated and you're 2 or 3 years down the road and you've kind of got your house in order. If you don't have that minimum GPA, what does that mean?
Those are all very common scenarios, and scenarios that I work with students in a lot. And that to me is the frustrating part about PA, because like you mentioned earlier, it's a new career. A lot of people, the majority of people, don't go into undergrad wanting to be PAs. So we run into that issue of damaged GPAs, essentially. And it's very hard to increase a GPA. It's tough, especially after you've had a lot of classes. It makes it even harder.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about minimums, if you see a minimum listed for a program, and 3.0 is the most common for overall and science GPA, it's a hard minimum. If you don't have that, based on the algorithm of CASPA, which is the Universal Application System, you're going to get weeded out and the school isn't going to see your application. And there's not really any way around that or any exception. So the options become retaking classes, anything, a prereq with a C or lower, taking additional science classes to raise those GPAs. And that can be done either individually by taking individual classes or by doing a more traditional post-bac program or master's program. And those can be helpful in those situations where someone really wants to show and prove that they can handle a rigorous master's program and prove to the schools that even though my GPA was struggling, I can, you know, I can handle this. And that's tough. I think one strategy for those students, you still have to meet the minimums, but because PA schools have such different requirements, if you look for schools that have more specific requirements, they're going to get less applicants. So if a school has 15 requirements and another school has 10 requirements, the one that has 10 is going to have more people apply because all those people that did all 15 are going to apply there and all the people that only did those 10. Whereas not as many people are going to be qualified for the school with more requirements. I think that's one strategy in choosing programs. I think it can be easy to look at the ones that only want the bare minimum, but they have so many applicants to choose from versus the schools that want you to do more on the front end. Does that make sense?
Okay. I've got some follow-up questions on the back of that.
Okay.
So what you're saying is you can use a master's degree to supplement a poor GPA from the undergraduate level.
It wouldn't replace it, but it would all, your overall GPA is every class you've ever taken from dual enrollment in high school to summer classes, your regular degree, post-bac, master's, anything goes into that.
So not just your undergraduate GPA, but all of the classes that you've taken. Okay.
Every class.
Okay, that's different from some other graduate programs where they rely solely on your undergraduates. Okay, so that's really helpful. You did mention some of the variety in terms of the application processes, and it seems like, you know, there's just so many different schools with so many different processes, which makes it hard. But what should you be looking for in a school? Because I imagine with 300-odd programs, they're probably not all equally good. There's probably some less than ideal situations out there.
I think you have to identify what's most important to you. And that's where I see applicants kind of getting into trouble is just picking schools they meet the minimums for and not really looking at what the school's about or where it is even. And then they get to the interview and think, I could never live here. I don't want to be here. And then they get accepted, and that's a hard decision. So I think you just have to decide, and whether that's location. My big ones were location and cost, and then looking at what the program offers as far as cadaver lab, or if they use models or computer anatomy lab, if they have great facilities, great rotation sites, are they going to send you to Timbuktu or are they going to keep you nearby? Is that important to you? And you're going to find people on both sides. Some people are going to say, yes, I want to only be able to do my rotations in Georgia. And then other people are going to say, no, I don't know where I want to work. I want to be able to go all over the place to figure that out. And so you have to look at everything about the program, which can be hard because after a while, all the program websites look the same. I really encourage students to go to information sessions if possible, which now so many of those are virtual, that you can sign up, go to their information session, get a feel for the faculty, get a feel for the director, the curriculum, and see if it's really something that you feel will fit you, that you'll excel in and be able to succeed.
And a lot of them are on YouTube too, so you don't even have to register. You can just go and watch them on demand.
For sure.
Is there much in the way of scholarships for PA school, or is it one of these things where you pay your own way?
Most everyone takes out loans. That actually is probably my biggest mistake or regret, is not trying to look for scholarships. I didn't think they were out there, but there are actually some out there, and some of them don't even take much work. It's you write a paragraph to see, and they may not even be getting that many entries. I posted about scholarships on Instagram recently, and someone actually messaged me and said that she had gotten a $3,500 scholarship from a paragraph she wrote, and it was something just very specific for healthcare graduate programs. And I mean, that's awesome. So I think
just submit one, just for the sake of it. Yeah.
Just try. Like, it's not going to take that much of your time. And usually when you've gotten into PA school, you have about a year before you start. So you can definitely take some time to get scholarships, but there aren't a ton. Some of the PA societies have them. AAPA, which is the National Society, has one, some through the PA Foundation, but definitely look at your school, see if there is anything available. It's worth just talking to the financial aid office and asking them about it, but the majority of it is loans for sure.
Yeah. I do want to get into the day-to-day life of a PA, but before we do that, I just want to turn quickly to, I guess, a pretty uniform part of every graduate school application, and that is some form of personal statement. Give us an outline on, you know, what the prompt tends to be, if there is such a thing as a common prompt, how long are these things generally, and what are some things to avoid and some little tricks to make sure you're heading in the right direction?
So the prompt is about the same every year. It's some variation of explaining why you've chosen to become a PA. Discuss your motivations for becoming a PA. Use the space below to explain why you want to be a physician assistant, something along those lines. You have 5,000 characters, including spaces, to enter that personal statement. That's about a page and a paragraph, single spaced. And it is important to stay on topic with that prompt. Everything in the essay should relate back to that why PA. That's the theme that's given to you, so you don't have to come up with a theme, which is nice. I edit a lot of personal statements, and there are a few kind of main things I look for answers to. I want to know why that person became interested in medicine. A lot of the things you've been asking me tonight, actually. How they found out about the PA profession. What they thought about it. Were they surprised? Were they confused? What did they think? And then from there, why they chose it. So why did that profession, when they did hear about it, resonate with them and make them feel like it was something that they wanted to pursue? And those things that they're explaining need to be specific to PA. If it could be used to explain any other profession, it's not specific enough. And then from there, I want to understand or see that they have an understanding of the PA profession, from shadowing or working with PAs, talking with PAs. And then I want to know what they've done to pursue it, with their patient care or volunteer experience, to move forward towards this goal to become prepared, also academically as well.
Yeah, that's all super helpful. And I think the other thing is just read the criteria, because as you said, it's going to vary so much from one school to another. Just take that extra 10 minutes and make sure you read things carefully. Let's jump into the day-to-day life of a PA. I guess my first question, and a lot of the time people mix the two professions or don't quite understand the distinctions between the two, but what is the difference between an NP and a PA?
The main difference is the training, and the other main difference will vary state to state. So what a PA versus an NP can do is extremely state dependent. I'm in Georgia. We function the same. Neither one can independently own practices, neither PAs or NPs. We all have a physician working with us in some capacity. So for me, even if I had pursued NP, I could be doing exactly the same thing. NPs can also work in any specialty. That's a common misconception, and that may be state dependent, but we have NPs in dermatology and really in every specialty. So they don't have to just be family medicine or women's health or pediatric. So that's kind of the main thing. Some states, NPs can own practices and PAs can't. Some states, there are differences in what they can prescribe or their independence or supervision levels. That just varies. As far as training, NPs start by going to nursing school. So they become nurses and then they go back to get their NP degree. There are a lot more online NP programs so that you could work as a nurse while you're getting that degree. But it's also more focused on the nursing model, which is, it's hard to explain the difference. I mean, in the medical model, we're trying to figure out how to solve a problem. The nursing model, you're learning to take care of the patient. But there's crossover in both because there has to be. And so in NP programs, from what I've heard, talking to nurses who have chosen to go the PA route, there tends to be a lot more papers and writing out plans versus tests like we do in PA school. Hmm.
I guess to follow up on the point of training being a distinguishing factor, do you have to specialize during your PA program? Is there a residency requirement at the end of your master's program? What does that look like?
There is no required program afterwards. We're trained as generalists. Our curriculum is set up to train us to work in a primary care setting. So we cover pretty much the basics: cardiology, pulmonology, hematology, oncology, dermatology, ophthalmology, infectious disease, nephrology, orthopedics, emergency medicine, pretty much every specialty in some form or fashion for different lengths of time. So once we're done, we can go work in any specialty or we can go work in primary care. I chose to go into dermatology and I went straight in without a residency. There are postgraduate training programs that are usually a year. Those are in areas typically right now like emergency medicine, surgery, ICU care, and I've seen some psychiatry ones as well.
So surgery is because as a layperson, I always thought of the physician as kind of internal medicine and surgeons were separate, but you can be a physician assistant and work in a surgical practice.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Oh, wow. Okay. Fantastic. What made you commit to dermatology? Is it something you fell into, or is it as you were going through your education, you're like, you know what, this is super interesting?
A little of both. I knew that I liked it from my shadowing experience in college. So I had a taste of it. And going into that, to be perfectly honest, I thought it was going to be super boring. I was not excited to shadow in derm. I thought, this is going to be all teenagers with acne and naked old people. This is going to be so boring, not exciting. But what I learned is skin can do really weird stuff, like full body rashes and huge, crazy looking lesions. So it just, I saw a lot that made me go, okay, maybe this is really interesting. And there are a lot of procedures, which I really enjoyed too. Once I got to PA school, I went in with an open mind. On rotations, still had an open mind. I really loved my surgical rotations though, especially being in an OR. I was with a general surgeon who did mainly breast cancer cases, mm-hmm. and he was amazing, great bedside manner, great surgeon, but he let me do a lot. I got to do a lot of suturing, a lot of assisting, really worked on skills during the time I was with him. And I thought, okay, I want to do surgery, but derm was still kind of in the back of my mind. Once I started looking for jobs, I applied to a bunch of stuff and I interviewed with neurosurgery, back surgery. Those are the main ones. And then I was kind of talking to like a urology group that would have been a surgical position as well. But then a derm job opened up and it was kind of perfect timing and made sense. The doctor I was working with at the time, the surgeon actually knew the doctor who was hiring. And so he called and, you know, got kind of put in a word for me. So I got an interview and it just, I mean, it was, I couldn't pass it up. I couldn't. And so I took the job in April and I actually didn't graduate till August, but I was already committed at that point.
With it being such a generalized education, it sounds like it's fairly straightforward to move from one practice area to another. So let's say you started out in derm and you were like, you know what, I want to go try my hand in oncology. It sounds like you can do that.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the pros of the career. I didn't really highlight that because it was a nice perk of choosing PA, but it wasn't my main reason. But it does give a lot of flexibility. So if I wanted to go work in, like you said, oncology or cardiology, I would just have to find a place that would train me and give me some time to refresh my knowledge. But I could definitely switch.
That's really interesting. What did you find was the biggest adjustment when you actually started practicing as a PA? Because I feel like in some ways it feels artificial. Like one day you're just a PA student or a PA grad waiting to pass your boards, or you're just a law student and then you pass the bar exam and then the next day you're a lawyer and you have all of these responsibilities. What was that adjustment like for you?
Exhausting. I was so tired.
I imagine the stress and the weight of like every decision that you make all of a sudden had consequences.
Well, it was just a lot and I was kind of eased into it. But in PA school, dermatology is only 4% of our boards and we only had 2 weeks of it and it was at the very beginning of my training. So I had derm, I think, August of 2012. And by the time I accepted a job and was starting, it was June of 2014. So it's 2 years later and I had 2 weeks of derm. So I did both of my elective rotations at my job. And so I was training and shadowing and learning. And then there was another about a month period where we were waiting on my licensing and board scores and stuff. So I was still training and shadowing and learning. And at about month four, they started slowly releasing me to see patients. So follow-ups, kind of easy things that I felt comfortable with. And it just slowly grew from there. But every day I was looking things up, researching, going home, studying, learning, listening to podcasts, reading. And I would go home and I would sit on the couch. And if I did sit down, I wouldn't get up. I just was so tired. My brain was tired. And so it took a while. Like, it was definitely an adjustment to the real world. I also had this, I remember like this moment of being like, I will never have another spring break or summer off where the school just tells me I don't have to come. Like, that doesn't exist in the real working world anymore. I have to schedule vacation time.
Yeah. Hashtag adulting.
Yes, exactly. Lots of adult things, taxes, learning how to do that.
And continuing professional education, too, is probably a component of things as well.
Oh, that's fun. Durham PAs know how to throw a conference, but yeah, that's the fun part. But yeah, it was just a lot. And so it took me, I would say, a good kind of 6 months to just feel adjusted and really feel like, okay, I'm get over that imposter syndrome. Like, I do actually know things. I'm helping people. I'm doing what I was meant to do. And yeah, 6.5 years later, still in derm.
That's fantastic. And I can just tell from listening to you that you enjoy it. But what would you say is the best thing about your practice area, but also being a PA?
Oh, gosh. Those are kind of different because I think being a PA, I do really enjoy what I do. I enjoy the flexibility the profession allows, and I enjoy being able to leave work at work. You know, I don't own the practice. I don't have to be involved with administrative decisions. I'm in a practice where I'm very fortunate that I can be involved if I want to be. But if it comes down to figuring out what color to paint the walls, and I don't really have a preference, I can go home. I don't have to sit in a meeting and talk about it. And so I enjoy not having those responsibilities. But the flexibility has helped me. About a year and a half ago, well, my daughter's 2.5. So I worked after I had her for a year, and then I decided I wanted to work part-time. And that was a hard decision because it meant leaving my practice because they didn't need or want me in a part-time role. And so it was either I stay full-time and sacrifice that family time, or I look for something else. And that was scary. I'd been there for 5 years. And being, you know, a PA in a smaller town where we all kind of knew each other, I turned in my resignation on Thursday at noon, and I had a job Friday at noon where they said, "You make your schedule. We know you're well-trained. We would love to have you. Tell us when you want to work." And
that's, you can't ask for a better outcome.
Yeah. It's like my work environment is something I never would have even dreamed of. It's just great. And so that to me is like such a great part of being a PA, because if you're not happy, you can leave. You can go do something else and find somewhere that appreciates you or works with your schedule and what you're looking for. So that part of the profession is really great. Working in derm, it's just fun. I see a mix of so many different things. We do medical, surgical, and cosmetic derm in my office. So I still get to do that surgery part. I'm doing excisions during the day, like cutting out skin cancers and cysts and stuff, kind of pimple popper things, but not nearly that big. And so that's really fun. And the patients I see, one thing that's interesting about treating skin is patients can see it getting better. So if someone comes in with a mole on their back that's driving them crazy, it's getting caught on their shirt or whatever all the time, and I can cut it off and give them relief, they're so happy. They're not happy when I inject lidocaine, but about 30 seconds later, they're happy. And then seeing a teenager with acne and watching them over a few months as their face clears up and their confidence gets better, it's just really rewarding. They just get happier, and that makes me happy also. Whereas I think compared to other areas of medicine, you know, if somebody comes in for their yearly physical, you tell them they have blood pressure issues, but they're feeling great, and you put them on a medicine that gives them a side effect, that's not going to make them very happy. And even if they are healthier because their blood pressure is better, they may not see that.
Yeah.
And so there's a little bit of instant gratification in working with derm, where you're able to kind of celebrate with your patients like, "Oh, your rash went away. Your itching went away. That's awesome." That other areas of medicine don't get to do quite as much.
Let's also ask another question on the back of that, because we want people to have a realistic picture. What is the thing that frustrates you the most about what you do?
As far as being a PA, not too much. I don't really get asked too much about my profession or have people who don't want to see me because of it. I really don't have any.
Is the paperwork overwhelming, or do you feel like you're actually able to do a lot more practice, or do you feel like the paperwork kind of weighs you down a little?
There's not too much paperwork. Sometimes I will get into arguments with insurance companies, and that can be frustrating. That's just medicine in general. And the logistics of everything, when they'll try to tell me to use a certain medication for something that's not, it's not even indicated for, I know it's not going to help my patient. That's frustrating. As far as derm, the most frustrating thing is having things I can't cure. There's a lot of stuff I can make better, but it takes some work on the patient's side too. And I have to tell them, "I'm never going to cure this for you. It's going to happen again. It's going to come back." Eczema, rosacea, acne, psoriasis, all kinds of stuff. And that's frustrating. Like, I wish that I had a magical medicine or something that I could use that would make things go away forever. But it just doesn't work like that. So I have to explain that a lot. I also can't tell in a lot of situations why something happened, like someone developing eczema or rosacea. I usually explain it like a sensitivity switch that gets flipped on. And once it's on, we can't turn it off. We can just figure out how to work around it. But a lot of times there isn't a single trigger or reason for something happening. And I think that's frustrating for patients because they want to know why. And I understand that. They want to know, okay, I'm 44 years old. Why do I have eczema now? What changed? I didn't change any products. What changed? So we have to have a conversation about your skin's different. It's a combination of a lot of things and work together to fix it as best we can.
What does a day look like for you on average, if there is such a thing? So you're working at a clinic right now as opposed to a hospital?
Yep.
I'm guessing that means your hours are pretty predictable?
Yeah.
What does a day look like for you from the time you get up until, you know, the time that your head hits the pillow?
Oh, gosh. So I'm an early riser. I usually wake up at like 5 and I will usually do some PA platform stuff until 7 when my daughter gets up, and then we get everybody ready. I'm at work by 8 and I only work Mondays and Tuesdays in the clinic. I work from 8 to 11:30, and during that time I'll start seeing patients. I'll be checking pathology reports from the last week from any biopsies or excisions I did or cultures, and figuring out what needs to happen with those, calling patients if needed, signing notes from the previous week or days, and then answering any telephone messages as well. But I'll see patients until about...
Voicemails from aspiring physician assistants.
Exactly, yeah. But I'll see patients until about 11:30. Usually my 11:30 spot is a surgery or a cosmetic procedure, something that's a little bit longer, just to give me a buffer going into lunch. We take lunch from 12 to 1. At 1, we'll start back seeing patients. My last patient's at 3:50. And again, that gives me a little buffer to have a longer appointment time if needed. And then I go home. I'm usually home by 4:35 and then come back and do it again.
And is it a 5-day-a-week thing, or do you 6 days a week? Like, what? Tell us a little bit.
I'm just 2 days a week. I'm just Mondays and Tuesdays.
But for someone who was in your role but full time, do they generally Monday to Friday? Do they have to do call work?
Some will do Monday through Friday. A lot of derm offices don't work Fridays, or they'll have like a half day.
Uh-huh.
So at my old office, I worked 4 days for a while, and then I worked 4.5 days for a while, or I would work like 1 Friday a month. And so that's pretty common. I don't take call at my office now. At my old office, I did. We don't get a ton of emergency calls in dermatology. It would be kind of maybe a couple a month,
yeah,
of things that weren't actually very urgent. We don't ever go into the office after hours or anything like that. We get holidays off. There's not too much outside commitment.
Hmm. That's helpful. One of the questions we ask every single person on the Professionist podcast is, what changes do they foresee coming to their profession in the next, 5 to 15 years? Because, we're in an age now where, especially, and we've seen that with COVID, technology is changing the way that we do our work, even in medicine. So what changes do you anticipate are coming to the career path of a physician assistant in this next 5 to 15 years?
It'll be interesting to see. In medicine in general, there's a push right now for transparency and access to information, which I think is a good thing. It's just logistically sometimes a nightmare. So even this past week, which I don't know when this will be live, but this is kind of April, legislation was passed that patient notes have to be available to them. So before, where they could request notes, now we have to make sure they can see those at any time. And so trying to make all that work with the computer system is part of that. So I don't know I feel like there will be more of that moving forward and just getting patients more involved in their care. For PAs, we are a newer profession, and I think with that comes sometimes some controversy. I guess there's controversy in every profession, probably a little bit. But there's talk right now of changing the name of PAs. There is a subset of PAs who don't like the word assistant in our name. So PA stands for physician assistant, which we're not. I'm not technically an assistant. Like, my doctor's not with me all day. She doesn't really go into patient rooms with me. It's more kind of a consulting relationship if needed. The name doesn't bother me. I went to school to become a PA. I know what I do. I feel like my patients at this point know what I do. But that is something that's being talked about. There's also talk about whether PA programs should be doctorate programs. And I also don't think that'll be adopted across the board. Maybe some programs will take that on. And just more recognition for the profession. Even in the past 6 years, I answer the question way less now about what's a PA? What do you do? Can you do this? Can you prescribe medicine? And so I think there is just more and more recognition, and I think that'll continue, which is a positive thing.
Yeah, I mean, it looks, looking at the statistics that I've seen, salaries are increasing, the demand for PAs is increasing. So it certainly seems like all indications are really positive. I want to turn now to the PA platform, you know, because one of the common themes of this podcast is a lot of people that we talk to are entrepreneurs, not everybody, but a lot of people. And the PA platform is your business. So help us understand why you decided to start it to begin with. Because you were working as a PA, and you decided, you know what, I'm going to start this other business on the side.
Yeah, so I've always needed something to do. I've always needed a project. And once I finished PA school, it was August, and I was working. It took me a while to get situated, but after I would say probably January or February after I graduated, I felt comfortable in my job. And I would come home. My husband was in med school, so he was really busy. He wasn't really there. And I was like, man, I gave up all my hobbies in PA school. I don't have any hobbies anymore. I've got to figure out what those are again, because for the past 2.5 years, this is all I've done. And I was like, I don't have any tests. I don't have any assignments. This is so weird. For the first time in 24 years. And so I decided that I needed to do something about that. So I started it as a blog. Fun fact, I started a fashion blog for about 2 weeks. And I was like, I am not a fashion blogger. This is not it. I don't know about this. Nobody wants to see my Old Navy shirt. Like, this is not working. My husband cannot take pictures of me either. So scratch that and went back to the PA blog idea, which I'd kind of started a couple times when I was in undergrad, documenting what I was finding and researching things and answering questions. And I just never kept up with it. Blogging is a lot of work. It takes a lot to do it. And so I never stuck with it. I couldn't have ever kept up with it during PA school. That would have been impossible. But people were still asking me questions about becoming a PA. And I was getting questions about it a lot. And I'd helped a lot of people with interview stuff and just figuring things out. One of my backup plans was actually to be a college advisor, because I loved planning people's schedules in college. They would come to me and be like, I want to go to med school. What do I need to take? What do I need to do? And I'd go, where do you want to go? Let's figure it out. And I just loved it. So I kind of took all that. And I remember I went to my husband and I said, I want to start a blog. And he was like, oh, what? He was like, how much is it going to cost? I was like, I think like $100. And he was like, okay, whatever, go for it. And so I took a couple weeks and got it all set up, did everything myself, and just started blogging. I just started writing, which I enjoy, about PA stuff, personal statements and PA schools and all that. And so I then started doing mock interviews, and it's really grown into just a community, because from there, that was about almost 5 years ago, and it's I mean, with the website and the podcast and books and conferences, it's just really cool to be able to connect with so many people.
Well, I think it speaks to the importance of being able to find the right niche too. Yeah. You know, there's no point trying to fill a niche that isn't really yours, or trying to fill a niche that a bunch of other people have already filled. It's like, what is the need, and how can you best meet that need? And that seems to be half the battle, is finding the right niche.
Well, and I think for me, what I found is I think I heard somebody say, like, what are you an expert in? And because I'd spent so much time figuring this out, I really felt like this is what I knew the most about. And also, what do you enjoy? Because if you're not enjoying it, it's not worth doing. And I burned out probably 4 months into doing the blog, because it's all I was doing and all I was thinking about. And I had to take a couple months off just to kind of reset and get back to it. And then I was able to make it into a fun thing versus an overwhelming thing.
That's a nice little lead off. I mean, the next question I was going to ask you is, like, what were some of the big challenges and teething problems that you had in actually getting this up off the ground?
Well, to start with, I did everything myself, and I started on WordPress, and it made me cry. I remember I went to this place for lunch while my husband was taking his step exams for med school. And so I was like, I'm going to go sit here for 8 hours and work on stuff. I spent 4 hours trying to move a sidebar from the left side of the page to the right side. And I was so angry at WordPress. And I was like, why am I doing this? This is the stupidest thing I've ever done. And after that point in time, I was like, all right, I either can't continue this, or I gotta figure something out. So I switched to Squarespace, and my life got a lot better.
People can't see this, but I'm laughing because I know that's very same experience. Gosh.
It was awful. It was so hard.
And then someone shows you how to do it, and you're like, gosh, how did I miss this?
Yeah. It's like you enter one little slash mark or something and it works. So yeah, so I'm not a web designer programmer. I learned that. And I've made a lot of mistakes. I spent a lot of time, I feel like this has been in the works for a long time. I've always looked at things about blogging and read and listened to podcasts about it and thought it was really interesting. And so, but yeah, looking back, I mean, I think I would have, you know, done blogs differently, or, you know, started social media sooner or differently. But I think for anybody, it's just that getting started and then sticking with it. Because over the past 5 years also, I've seen so many people come and go.
Yeah.
Where they'll start out really strong and then they just kind of fade away, which that's fine. Again, if you're not enjoying it, don't do it. It's not worth it. But I think if anyone's like wanting to actually start something, you have to try. I've failed at plenty of other things I've tried to do, by the way. So,
well, podcasting is a classic example. You know, the average podcast dies after about 7 or 8 episodes because it's a ton of work.
It is.
To make it happen.
I'm on episode 182 of my podcast. Yeah, missing a week. So
I got some ground to catch up. What advice would you have for someone just stepping outside of the PA question altogether? What advice would you have for someone who's kind of got this kind of bug in their ear about starting a business, and maybe they're telling themselves a narrative that says, I can't do this or it won't work? What pushed you over the edge to actually just do it?
I don't know. I've never been someone who really had limiting beliefs, which is a problem at times, to be perfectly honest. Last year, I tried to start a children's clothing company. It was fun, but it lasted about 6 months. And I was like, I don't like customer service like this. And baby moms are crazy. So we're going to tap out of that one. But I mean, just don't be afraid to fail. Try it and just start, because that's what I think. I'd been consuming content for so long and listening to podcasts and videos and reading blog posts about getting started when I should have, you know, read a blog post, did what it recommended, and actually taken an action and then consumed something else. And I think I heard that at some point when I was listening to all of this, like, hey, listen, if you're listening to my podcast and not actually doing anything about it, you need to step back and start taking action before you keep listening. And so I was like, oh, you're right. Like, if I really want to do this, I should just start and just do it and see what happens. And if I was getting personal fulfillment from it, it didn't really matter whether anyone else, you know, thought it was great or looked at it either. So that's what I mean, seeing that we just hit 39,000 followers on Instagram, I'm like, that's so weird. Yeah. Why does anyone follow me?
It's incredible when you see the numbers like that. I mean, what you're just saying, it reminds me of a post we did this week. It was a quote from General Patton, and he said, a good plan violently executed is better than a perfect plan next week.
Right.
And sometimes exactly. It's just being, I mean, failure is it's an unavoidable component of success. No one has ever done anything worthy of note without having failed many, 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 many times before.
Yeah. So. I kind of wish I'd written down my failures at this point, but I bounce back pretty quickly. I'm just kind of like, oh, that didn't work. Move on. Let's try something else. I don't really let it get to me that much.
And it seems like that's a common trait with anyone who's tried a few different businesses, is this ability to pick themselves up, learn from the lessons, and then apply them to the next enterprise.
Yeah.
I want to jump into some questions that we've had from folks who follow us on Instagram. If you have questions that you would like us to put to any of our guests, just head on over to @theprofessionists on Instagram. You can contact us at contact@theprofessionist.com and, you know, send us through those questions. We're happy to put them to our guests. Okay, so Savannah, our first question is from Luke. He's from Dallas, Texas, and he says, I'm a pre-nursing student, and I've always thought about going down the nurse practitioner route, but I find myself considering becoming a PA. Why would you choose one over the other? And I know you touched a little bit on the training being different. But
yeah. I would just talk to both. If you're in a nursing or hospital setting, talk to NPs, talk to PAs, especially look at your state and see what the laws say about each, to see if NP in your state would pigeonhole you into certain specialties. It may not be the ones you want to do. Look at that. If you're looking to own a practice and wouldn't be able to as a PA, look at that. But definitely just talk to the PAs in your location and the NPs. And then I have some podcast episodes, and probably the easiest way to find things, if you just search the PA platform nurse, they'll pop up. But I talked to Kanan Brown. He's on YouTube and Instagram, and he's an RN who chose to go to PA school, and he's actually in PA school now. So he talks about that a lot and his decision. And then I did another podcast with a girl named Crystal, who's also in PA school now. And they had very similar stories of how they talked to nurses and people who had gone through both programs and really felt like the education you get as a PA was what they were looking for their particular paths and what they wanted to do.
That's helpful. Our next question is from the Midwest. It's from Peter. He's in South Bend, Indiana. And he says, I'm 30 years of age and have been working in sales since I left college. I was a marketing major, but really want to pursue a career in healthcare, and becoming a PA ticks all of those boxes. However, I'm worried about my age and not having a STEM degree. Is it a pipe dream, or can I actually do this?
Okay, you can definitely do it. Not a pipe dream at all. This is actually what the PA program was designed for, as a second career, to give people kind of an entryway into medicine. And I've heard and worked with people who have such similar stories to that I think if you are feeling like that would fulfill you in ways that your career is not currently, you know, doing that for you, then go for it. Our PA school class, our oldest student was 40. It's not uncommon to have older students, and I wouldn't call 30 old, by the way.
Yeah, but
we had plenty of 30-year-olds in my class. And to give you just a little anecdote, one of my best friends, her name's Taylor. She was actually my medical assistant for 5 years at my previous practice. She was a PR major and ended up moving to our area, couldn't find a PR job she liked, ended up working as a receptionist at the derm office, got moved to the back to work as a medical assistant, figured out she loved medicine. She was there doing that for, I think, 7 or 8 years, and then decided she wanted to become a PA. So she started taking the prerequisite classes, doing all of the requirements. She had the patient care experience. So that's one area you'd need to get. But she is in her rotations now and actually going to come do a rotation with me. So you can definitely change your mind and change your career and just figure out ways to make that happen. But yeah, I say go for it.
Yeah, career change is possible at almost any point, but it does require some actual planning and dedication, and sometimes it takes a few steps backwards before you go forward. You can obviously just head on over to www.theprofessionist.com. You can check out one of our blog posts where we just walked through 7 of the steps that you should be looking at if you are contemplating a career change. But let's go to Tonya from Tulsa, and she says, how hard is it to balance the demands of PA school with being in a relationship? And how does that balance change when you graduate? I'd like to have a family and am curious as to how it looks to balance that.
During PA school, relationships are tough. I saw in my class many relationships end, but also a lot of great relationships that started during PA school and led to weddings. Actually, I think there was one Saturday after graduation that there were 4 weddings of people in our class. So it's definitely possible to have a good relationship during PA school. At the time when I started PA school, I was engaged. My husband was in medical school. I lived at home. We did not see each other much at all during that first didactic year. We were in a little bit of a different situation because I think there was an understanding there of what we were going through and how school was our priority. We might would grab lunch or study together once a week. And then come May, we showed up at our rehearsal dinner after we'd both had tests that day and got married the next day. And so for us, that was a priority, even if it meant doing tests and studying and then having a shorter honeymoon. So it's all about priorities and also a lot of communication, a lot of expectations. Especially if someone is like has a non-medical partner, being able to say, you know, this is my priority. I might not be as available to you. We might have to talk when I'm in the car because I really need this study time, and having someone who's going to understand that. Once we got married and I started clinical year, it was way better. My schedule wasn't as tough. We saw each other a lot more. And then as far as graduate life, that's where it's up to you. And people like to throw around the words work-life balance, but that's just not a thing that exists unless you make it exist, because places will take advantage of you. And if you're willing to work, you're going to work. So for me, after working for a while, paying off my loans, and then having a child, I just wanted to be home with her more. And so I made that a priority and did that because it was what was important to me. So I think as long as you keep communicating, know what's important to you and make decisions that reflect that, you can definitely maintain a good relationship and have a good family balance too.
We got another one from the Midwest. Shauna, in Lansing in Michigan. She said, I've heard that getting into PA school is harder than medical school because there are fewer places. Why did you choose to become a PA over a doctor? And I think we've kind of addressed a little bit of this during the course of it, but do you have any other thoughts?
It is hard. And I think for me, like, I've just never been that person who feels like I need to have the final say or, you know, be the person necessarily in charge. Like, I really did just want to help patients. and make decisions for, like, help them make decisions. And so I saw that I could fulfill that as a PA and skip all of the not fun parts of medical school. And I just jumped on that. There maybe been two instances where I thought, oh man, I wish I had a residency. We saw something really rare, that my doctor had only seen once in residency or something. But when I really look at it, by the time I got to the age where I would have finished residency, I already had 6 years of experience as a PA under my belt. So that to me it just means a lot.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Our last question is a little bit of a cheeky one from Tony, who's in Memphis. He says, my girlfriend says I have the handwriting of a medical professional. I can remember when prescriptions were written by hand. Do you take notes by hand, or do you find that most of what you do involves a tablet in clinical practice? It might sound like a silly question, but I'm a little worried about my handwriting.
So that's an interesting question for me, because we are actually pretty much on paper charts in my office. And my old office was completely EMR on the computer. So it wasn't
so too EMR much being of an issue. Electronic medical records?
Medical records, yeah, on the computer. So the only issue I had with writing things down, which I also have terrible handwriting, was if I had to write instructions for a patient. But a lot of times my medical assistant would do that. So now that we're on paper chart, I have to try to pay attention to my handwriting a little bit. But I'm not nearly as bad as the doctor. There are plenty of times.
I feel like there's a class in med school. It's like medical handwriting 101. Forget everything you learned about cursive.
It just gets worse. It gets worse over time. That's the thing. Like, I see mine getting worse, and I see it when I'll see something I wrote and I can't read it. And that's bad. That's not good. I'm like, I don't know what this said. Oh, no. So we'll all get together, like me and the four medicals, and we're like, okay, what do we think this letter is? What do we think this says? And come up with it the best we can. But yeah, so it's most stuff's on the computer now, especially prescriptions, but it still is sometimes an issue.
So maybe just practice, Tony. Maybe just yes. Practice your cursive a little.
I found just slowing down is helpful, but I'm also the person who in 8th grade, I decided to stop dotting my I's because it was taking too long. So I don't know if that tells you anything.
Well, Savannah, thank you so much for your time. This has been, I think, very interesting for our listeners, and we've certainly learnt a lot more about the career path of a physician assistant. If you've got more questions about this career path, head on over to thepaplatform.com. She's also on Instagram, the PA Platform, and of course the PA Platform podcast. And again, remember there's that great discount code that we talked about at the very beginning of the episode, FUTUREPA, and that'll get you a 10% discount on any of the services that are available over on the PA Platform. Savannah, thanks for joining us and for helping us find our fit.
Yes, thank you so much for having me, Ben.